We want to remove social barriers. We want to remove environmental barriers that keep young children, whatever attributes they bring to us, from experiencing something that is rightfully theirs to experience.
What's a child with a visual impairment? You know, what are their sensory needs? How would they be able to explore a museum like a child with a vision could? And that's where this all kind of came from. Amiko is young, and I wanted him to experience something that maybe somebody with his visual impairment hadn't even experienced before, but he gets to experience it as a child.
Miko's experience in the world is so different than ours. It has to, like, without that one sense, his other senses have to, like, it has to encompass the entire thing he wants to explore. Feeling with his feet is so important. Getting to walk around the perimeter, to have sensory, you have to be able to explore it in so many different ways.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to Think Inclusive, real conversations about building schools where every learner belongs. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today's episode is about what it looks like to translate fine art for young children with visual impairments and what it teaches us about inclusion, belonging, and co-creating inclusive environments. Our guests today include Dr. Michael Barla, whose residency with the Clifford Still Museum in Denver led him to design a fully sensory-based translation of a Clifford Still painting for a young child with visual impairments. We're also joined by Jen Taylor, a teacher of students with visual impairments, and Taylor Kingsbury, the parent of Miko, the toddler who got to experience the piece firsthand. We talk about how the project came to life, why translation matters more than replication, how young children with visual impairments navigate spaces differently, and what museums and schools alike can learn about rightful presence, accessibility, and co-creation with community. It's a fantastic conversation about art, disability, and imagining worlds where every child belongs and is invited to explore with all their senses. Before we meet our guests, I want to tell you about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by IXL. IXL is an all-in-one platform for K-12 that helps boost student achievement, empowers teachers, and tracks progress all in one place. As students practice, IXL adapts to their individual needs so that every learner gets just right support and challenge, and each student gets a personalized learning plan to close gaps. Check it out at IXL.com/inclusive. Again, that's IXL.com/inclusive. All right, after a quick break, it's time to think inclusive with Michael Barla, Jen Taylor, and Taylor Kingsbury. Catch you on the other side.
So I'm Michael Barla, and I now work here at the Anchor Center for Blind Children in Denver, Colorado. I had a pretty long public school career. Then I taught in higher ed before landing here at the Anchor Center. And my role for this project, I was awarded for 3 weeks in the summer of 2024. So last summer, Institute Residential Fellowship with the Clifford Still Museum here in Denver. And the Clifford Still Museum is a single artist museum dedicated to the work of Clifford Still that is housed here. His widow chose Denver. And so the works that the museum holds, which is 93% of all works that Clifford Still ever made, now belong to the city and county of Denver. And the will specified that those works would go to an American city who would house a space, build and house a space for his works. So that is how the city of Denver ended up with the Clifford Still Museum here. So I am the person who had the fellowship, and I will turn it over to Jen, who was my thought partner in that fellowship process.
Yes. So my name is Jen Taylor. I am a teacher for students with visual impairments. I first started out teaching in East Texas for a couple of years, and then I came to the Anchor Center about 5 years ago. And then as currently, I still partner with the Anchor Center, but I work for Cherry Creek as of now. And I was the, somebody had sent me an email. I think it was our head office person and our director, and they wanted me to collaborate with Michael on an art project for a student with a visual impairment. And that's how we kind of got connected.
Amazing. Thank you.
And I'm Taylor Kingsbury. I am the mother of Miko Kingsbury, who was the child that got to participate in the experience that was offered by Michael, Dr. Barla. And we were referred by Jen. Miko has been at the Anchor Center as a student since he was 6 months old.
Ah, so Michael, you had a fellowship. And when you say Anchor Center is different from STILL. Is that right?
That's correct. And Anchor Center is a center for children with visual impairments and blindness that was founded by the Delta Gamma fraternity. And they have a beautiful facility here in Denver. So the process was me applying for the fellowship, being awarded the fellowship, but in the process of applying and thinking about the project that I wanted to complete during that fellowship, I was then connected to Jen, who at that time was a teacher for students with visual impairments here at the Anchor Center. So it gets a little convoluted because since that time, Jen has moved on to the Cherry Creek School District, and I left the university where I was and came here to work at the Anchor Center full-time as the office manager. So a year ago, things looked different than they look right now for Jen and myself. So the consistency here is Taylor and Miko and Taylor's dad, Keith, who, are still amazing family. And so they're the consistent piece. Jen and I have made a little shift in what it is we're doing.
Okay. And so Miko went to the Anchor Center. And walk us through this for Michael. Walk us through the process was this just for Miko, or like you were modifying or adapting this exhibit? Am I saying that right? I may not be using the right language.
It's okay. I'll just give a brief overview of the process or the steps that I was thinking about and going through. To take you back to around the beginning of COVID, actually, so 2020, I was approached by the Clifford Still Museum to be a consultant on an exhibit where they wanted children 6 months of age to 6 years of age to curate an exhibition of Clifford Still's work. And so I was brought in as a consultant to help the museum think about how we can take a very traditionally designed and set up adult-driven space and really think about how we can bring children into that space. And my background has been mostly working with children who have a wide variety of attributes that they bring to their lived experience. And so that exhibition was called Art and the Young Mind. And it ran from March to August of 2022. And so I was helping them try and think, for lack of a better way of saying it, outside the box about how children could be engaged in a museum, especially one that is very adult driven and designed. Mm-hmm. So I had that experience. And then I kept thinking about that experience. And so when I saw the application come out to be a residential fellow, I then started to think, well, what if I honed in on one specific attribute? And that attribute would be young children with visual impairments or blindness. And what can I, or what can we think about when we think about, and I use the word translating, so when we think about translating a piece of Clifford Still's work for a young child who is visually impaired or blind, what might that look like? So I applied, I was accepted, and then I was connected with Jen at the Anchor Center as a thought partner in my process of thinking about how I might translate a piece of Clifford Still's work. And Jen is the one who thought of Miko, And bringing him to the museum, and we can talk about that later, to experience the translation that I built of a piece of Clifford Still's work. So I honed in on one painting that, while I was in residence there, had never been exhibited by the Clifford Still Museum. So that it was called PH914. Clifford Still had his pieces numbered and not named or given a title because he didn't want the person experiencing the artwork to have a preconceived idea or notion of what he thought about that piece of artwork. So they're all numbered. And the one that I chose was PH914. And so I then spent a couple of weeks of that fellowship really digging into the archives that they hold at the museum, trying to get an idea of Clifford Still's thinking at the time, which was in the 70s, in which he made PH914. And then just started to think about how I might translate that one specific painting into a sensory experience for a child with a visual impairment or blindness. And that's where Jen comes into the picture to help me. She really helped me think about the wide variety of ways that I might translate or try and represent. I didn't want to replicate the piece. If I was replicating his work, I would try and paint the painting. And that's not my goal in the whole experience.
Yeah.
So in that translation, Jen really helped me. We met a couple of times in thinking about different ways that children with visual impairments and blindness access their environment. So okay. Then,
yes. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. So then Jen, in thinking about this project, thought about Miko and his family. And then they were invited to the museum toward the end of my project for Miko and his parents to experience the piece that I had built.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That it brings it much more clear. Okay. So Jen, I have a question for you. So what was your approach working with Michael on how to begin this translation?
Well, I mean, we first started, you know, just meeting face to face, and, you know, he told me what painting he wanted to use. And, you know, I wanted to think in terms of, you know, a child without vision. So Miko does not have any vision. I'm visually impaired, so I have low vision. But I wanted to think of a child, because any child with any type of vision would be able to experience this painting. But I wanted it for a child that couldn't see. And so what are the ways that we could do that? And we talked about sound, and we talked about texture, and we talked about, you know, even like some bright enough light that maybe he could see it, and just bringing it alive without the sense of sight. And we just sat down and we brainstormed. And, you know, originally we didn't know what student we were going to pick either. So at the time it was just like, you know, what's a child with a visual impairment? You know, what are their sensory needs? How would they be able to explore a museum like a child with vision could? And that's where this all kind of came from. And it's just a lot of brainstorming and, you know, just making lists and seeing what works and, you know, narrowing down your ideas, because there's a plethora of different ideas. I mean, we even thought about bringing water into it, because kids with visual impairments have such sensory with water, but we, you know, couldn't do that. But we were like, what are other things we can do? So we brought in sound and the texture and the lights and just, you know, and then it came down to like, okay, are we going to use Miko? And then, you know, talking to his parents. And, you know, Miko is young, and I wanted him to experience something that maybe somebody with his visual impairment hadn't even experienced before, but he gets to experience it as a child.
Right.
Firsthand.
Right. So one more question for Jen, because I want to talk about like what it ended up being, right? Mm-hmm. How the translation kind of, well, the final iteration of the translation. And then I want to ask Taylor about Miko's experience. So what did it end up being? And how did you end up, like, how did you end up figuring out what you wanted it to be? I guess that's the question.
Well, I guess for me, once he showed me which one we were doing, I was like, okay, well, what would that look like in terms of if I didn't have vision? How would I feel these things? Because, for instance, like there's this like blue stripe that's going down, and it kind of, he made it where it's like kind of got these rocks on it, and it's a little velvety. And then like the orange, I think we paired with the bells, right? because this is like a long time ago, so I'm trying to recall everything that we did. And so I tried to look at the image as a whole and say, okay, I visually see this, but how would this work? And, you know, he's also at the time, he was barely a toddler. So this is a young child experiencing this. So it was kind of like, what are simple things that he already likes, you know? Cause I think at that time we did figure out, you know, like I said, I wanted to do it with a student that had no vision. So a lot of that's got to be sound. And again, like I say, I go back to the texture thing and really that's how it all came about, just narrowing down those things that would, you know, based on looking at these colors and these patterns. And again, it's a lot of brainstorming, a lot of talking it through, and not every idea made it to the end.
I'm wondering, Tim, if I could just also add a little bit to Jen's great description. What, from my point of view, and I got to spend a lot of time sitting in the gallery where that piece was exhibited and just sitting and watching patrons and visitors to the museum come and watch their interactions with that piece. This kind of may sound, I don't know how it sounds, but I kind of let the piece guide me in that process of how it was I thought I might translate that. So I'm not sure if you're aware, but there is at least one company in the United States that will 3D print a piece of artwork. And for me, that wasn't what I wanted, because the 3D-ness of it is wonderful in one capacity, but it doesn't really delineate if you have a change in color or if you have a change in texture on the painting. Or, for example, this painting that I used, Clifford Still used a palette knife to paint it. He rarely used a brush, mostly used a palette knife. And so when he would load that palette knife and then get to the end of a stroke, there are some wispy pieces of paint that are on the canvas at the end. And so for me, I thought, how can I reproduce that? And that's where the, I guess, ostrich feathers came in that I cut and put for those wispy pieces at the end. And so, you know, it was just me thinking about the different aspects of that piece and how I might represent them so that someone understands or begins to understand that there is a difference in the pieces and the colors and the textures and perhaps what the artist was trying to convey in that piece, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Taylor. tell me the story of Jen coming to you and being like, hey, I've got this idea.
Yeah, so I remember it very well. We were in the Lightroom. Jen was the teacher in there. And the Lightroom is a room that's very dark, but all of the toys and interactive areas have really bright lights. And so Mika was in there playing, I'm sure with a very loud toy. And Jen, we generally do get to just kind of like chit chat a little bit when Mika would be in school. And so Jen and I were just talking and she just said, hey, I don't know if you're interested, but I've got this friend who's doing this art residency and he's actually building out this piece that would be for children who are blind or visually impaired. And we really want a child to try it out. Do you think Mika would be interested? And I tend to be pretty game for stuff like that. I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, please. And thinking about it now, I know one piece of it, I was so excited. I was a little nervous because Miko's a pretty tough crowd. Like he's very particular. Like he, if he doesn't like something, he will definitely let you know. And so I was excited, but I was like, oh no, like, I'm worried for Dr. Barlow that he's going to think his piece isn't great if Mika goes in there and he's like, no, thank you. But nevertheless, I'm always open for Mika having those kind of experiences. And so I was really excited to get to participate.
And so when did Mika go to it? I'm assuming Mika went to the museum, right? And so was it multiple sessions or was it one kind of big day or how did that happen?
Sure. So the fellowship was 3 weeks in length. And so Miko came to the museum toward the end of that fellowship because I had to have time to build the piece.
Right.
And so he came. I invited Miko and his parents, and Jen was there as well, to the museum on a Monday when the museum is closed to the public, because I wanted to, as much as possible, lessen maybe other sensory stimuli or distractions for that time. So he came once. I think they were there for maybe it was between an hour and 90 minutes, probably. They came in order for Miko to have an experience of interacting with the piece that I built. And I'm not sure, Tim, if you want me to go into kind of what that looked like, and then
Yes, please.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then maybe bounce back to Taylor for her impressions of that experience. But so I had some other fellows who were there. There were five of us, I believe. A couple of them wanted to observe this interaction and process. So there were a couple of other adults sitting in the gallery as well. So we chose to present the piece to Miko first as a horizontal piece, almost laying on the floor. It was on some foam bricks. So there was a little bit of space between the piece, the frame of the piece, and the floor. So it was laying basically on the floor, and that was the way that we presented it to him first. And there were a couple things that happened during that time that were very impactful for me. And they came from Taylor, a couple of questions that Taylor had posed. The first one was, would she be able to remove Miko's shoes and socks? And I said, of course. And when she did, his feet instantly went up on the piece that I had fabricated. And he was exploring all over with his feet. And I, not being a person who is trained to work with individuals with visual impairments or blindness, did not know that many young children begin to explore with their feet before they begin to explore with their hands. And I found that just really, really fascinating. The other thing that Taylor asked was, would it be okay if Miko explored under the piece? So the underside, or what we would call the back of the frame that I built. And of course, yes, please let him do that. And he was quite enamored with the underside of the piece. And some people might think, oh, that's the opposite of what you want him to be. No, I want him to do what he wants to do and to have the experience that he wants to have with that piece. So it was quite fascinating for me to be able to sit back and watch him navigate around the piece as he explored the underside as well as the top of the piece. When we felt like maybe attention is waning a little bit, and consider, I believe Taylor, he was 2 at this time, I asked Taylor and Keith if it would be okay if I put the piece up vertically. And so we moved the piece, we stood it up next to a half glass wall, and it was a whole different experience for him because he was now at the actual level of those half marbles that I had put on the piece, and the lights and the feathers and just all the textures that were there. And it was a different experience from my perspective in the way that he navigated that piece when he was up on his 2 feet and able to have that piece right in front of him. So I'll let Taylor, you know, speak to her experience as well.
After the break, we head into the gallery with Miko and his family to see how a toddler who has a visual impairment explores a work of art, mapping it with his feet, his hands, his face, and all of the sensory information he can gather. And what a moment-by-moment exploration teaches us about building environments where every child can belong. But first, here's a quick word from our sponsor. And it's a new sponsor, and we're so happy to have Adaptiverse sponsor this episode and many more episodes to come. If you're a special education teacher, you already know the time problem. Every week, educators spend 15 to 20 hours manually adapting curriculum, especially for students with complex communication needs. We're talking about
non-speaking learners, AAC users, students with apraxia, or language-based disabilities. And creating personalized materials, building visual supports, designing multiple expressive pathways for the same lesson, it's critical work. But it's exhausting, and it pulls teachers away from actually teaching. Adaptiverse changes all of that. Teachers simply describe what they're teaching and who they're teaching, and the platform generates grade-level academic lessons personalized to each student's needs, with built-in scaffolding and multiple ways to demonstrate understanding. And these are not watered-down worksheets. These are rigorous lessons that presume competence and increase engagement through personalization. Adaptiverse is built on 60-plus years of combined educational experience, and it's already being used to create more than 2,000 lessons in 35 states, with educators calling it life-saving and irreplaceable. If you're ready to get those hours back and focus on what matters most, visit adaptiverseapp.com to learn more.
Yeah, so we arrived at the Clifford Still Museum and got taken up to the gallery where Dr. Barla and Jen were waiting with the piece. And Miko sometimes can be kind of hesitant about new environments. But I mean, we set him down and he immediately started walking around, like feeling people that were there. And then we led him over to the piece. And like Dr. Barla said, he immediately took to it. He sat down in my lap and just kind of started touching and feeling and then put his whole face on it. And I'm sure Dr. Barla is going to talk about the heart attack that Miko gave him. But Miko, there were little bells on it, and Miko immediately like put his face down and like bit off one of those bells and had it in his mouth. And I, you know, was like, it's fine. He spit it out. Like, it's okay. And Dr. Barla's just, you know, kind of like starting to sweat a little bit. But Miko's experience in the world is so different than ours. It has to, like, without that one sense, his other senses have to, like, it has to encompass the entire thing he wants to explore, right? So the underside was so important. All of the different textures were important. Feeling with his feet is so important. Getting to walk around the perimeter. He even like walked over to the bench and then would walk back to the piece. And so we call it mapping. He's a pro at it, but he builds up this in his mind, what this looks like or what this is, by getting as many sensory inputs as possible with this piece. And he loved it. It was so great. And then, like Dr. Barla said, as soon as they set it up, he was back to exploring it. It ends up being a whole new thing for him. He wanted to feel the back again. He wanted to see where the perimeter was. He wanted to feel everything that he couldn't really get to unless he physically sat on the piece, because he was two. So I think that that's a really important lesson, or a really important point, when it comes to how great this piece was, is that, you know, it's to have sensory, you have to be able to explore it in so many different ways. And so on the bottom, sitting up with feet, with hands, with face, unfortunately. And yeah, it was incredible. Miko, he loved it. He, you know, he didn't really have any issues with feeling it or getting excited about it.
Did, how much did you explain to Miko, what would like the purpose of being at the museum? Like, did he know, like, hey, I'm gonna go experience art, or like, what was that like?
Yeah, for us, so when you have a child with a visual impairment or with extreme blindness like Miko, you do this thing that everyone talks about, which is like sports broadcasting. So you have to basically talk and explain, like, just like you do like on the radio. And so, yeah, we talk him through the whole ride over, like, oh, we're going to the museum. Miss Jen's going to be there. We're going to like look at, we're going to feel some art. I'm sure I said look at some art, but yeah, we talk, even if he doesn't understand, it's really important that we talk through these points with him and that he knows. And so we get to the museum and we drop him on the ground and we're like, okay, the piece is over here. And then talk him through, oh, this color's orange, like, and it has the bells. And then, oh, do you feel those little wispy pieces? It's actually black and it's moving on the canvas. And so, yeah, you tend to want to explain or at least give a piece of verbal confirmation to everything that's happening. And that just kind of adds to his experience.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. But thank you for explaining that. I think that's important for, you know, anyone who's listening to kind of understand. So had this even been a consideration, like, you know, museums are very, that's a very typical thing to have, right? In a community is a museum. Had you ever thought that a museum might want to translate an experience or exhibit for a child like Miko?
No. Well, you know, we are very avid supporters of children's museums. And so we go to quite a few children's museums, but those do tend to be more like interactive based. As far as like fine art goes, no, absolutely not. And art is very important to me as a person. I'm a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma. So I grew up on my reservation in Oklahoma. And my grandmother was a seamstress. My mother was a seamstress. My father was he worked with silver and leather. And I always drew and also sewed. And so I was always very driven by art and driven by the ability to like make things and dream up ideas. And so when we found out Miko was blind, it was this whole piece that I hadn't really reconciled, that I was like, oh, my child's going to get to like draw me things and stuff. But until he was blind and I started thinking about those experiences that I love so much in my life, like going to museum and experiencing art, that I was like, oh my gosh, that's not attainable for him. Like, that's just something that he's never going to be able to experience in this way. And so when we were approached about this, there was a piece of me that, you know, I was so thankful for, because it was just something that I just didn't think Miko would ever get to experience in a way that would help him, I don't know, like just open up the world of fine art in museums. Because you're right, they are very much for sighted people, very much for adults also generally. And if Miko cannot go into a space and use the tools that he has, like his hands, like his feet, or even like audio descriptions, which some museums don't even have that, he will never be able to experience that. And so, no, I did not expect that. And so that's one reason when Jen offered it to us, I was like, yes, like count us in. We want to do this because it is so important to me. And I knew that Miko would love the experience.
Yeah. And one more question for you, Taylor, because for it, our audience is mostly educators who, you know, are interested in inclusion, a lot of special education teachers, principals, district administrators. So I do want to make a tie-in to kind of like developing environments of learning, right, that are universally designed. So I guess, what would you hope people that are listening would take away from this experience that Miko and your family, you know, took part in?
So I would say that I would hope they would take away from this that you have to start including inclusion into the mission of your work. You have to start seeing people who have disabilities, who have, you know, are different abled, as an equal participant in this world. And that could be through, you know, looking at your hiring processes, looking at your program designs, your evaluation. Is your evaluation only for able-bodied, sighted, fully hearing kiddos? Or do you offer evaluation for kids that might not meet that criteria? And I would also encourage everyone to if you, in your in community, if you have an organization or if you want to do research into an organization and you want to know how to start doing this, like community is vital in these spaces. Like Jen can't do it alone. Dr. Barla can't do it alone. I cannot do it alone. Like we have to all get in this together. And it isn't something that you design for these children. Like you just, you have to co-create with your community these spaces. Because I could tell you what Miko loves to do. We could go to the Anchor Center and he could be the only blind child that loves to do that. Like all the other kids could be like, absolutely not. So it has to be in co-creation with the whole community. And there are so many people that are doing this great work that are so available and so willing to offer up expertise and to offer up their children like me to experiment on or to give advice about or to, you know, offer up their own resources. So train your staff, empower them with disability awareness and, you know, have the confidence that you might not do it right, but your steps to get there and respecting these children and being enthusiastic about including them is going to make all the difference, not only in your attitude towards these kiddos and this community, but also you're like, the kids are going to mimic that attitude. Other adults are going to mimic that attitude. And it just starts to create a really positive, inclusive environment.
Awesome. Thank you for that. This next question is for Jen. The experience that you had working with Michael on translating this piece, if another museum wanted to, you know, consult with you and be like, hey, we heard about what you did at the Still, what advice would you give to those institutions who want to create more like inclusive experiences for children with visual impairments?
I think reaching out to, you know, a lot of our public school districts, I mean, there is a shortage, but there are teachers for students with visual impairments. The Anchor Center, you know, they have a website and they have a phone. They can direct you to the right people. But if you can find somebody that specializes, and it's hard to, but if you can find somebody that knows how to work with a child with a visual impairment and blindness, and you can bring them in, they won't. I don't know anybody that would say no to this. I mean, art is very important to everybody, and it's art can be created in multiple ways. It doesn't have to be like what we consider traditional art. So it's one of the most, I think, easiest things to accommodate for anybody. So if you just bring along somebody that has a little bit more expertise in the realm of working with kids and families with visual impairments, if you can find that person, I think that will help a lot because you can, because we're trained to know specifically what kids need and, you know, we're also trained for public outreach and community. And you know, a lot of us are always willing to help if you, you know, if you reach out and ask.
Great, great advice. Michael, what are your thoughts on, you know, well, I guess, first of all, I just want to say that this is such a unique idea. Like it shouldn't be a unique idea, right? this experience and this opportunity that you had was unique, but it really should be something that everyone, you know, no matter what space you're in, should be considering is, you know, we have people in our community that are visually impaired or hearing impaired or, you know, have other various disabilities. How can we co-create to what you were saying, Taylor? I think that I love that phrase is co-create this environment so that everyone can experience and feel like a sense of belonging, right? So, Michael, what are your thoughts about how we can ensure that this isn't just a one-time thing, but that we can sustain and build on this experience for everyone in our community?
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's a tough one, but also maybe in one regard and in another, it's not so hard to answer. But I want to bring up another experience that happened while I was in residence there. I happened to be walking upstairs to the galleries and see a group of adults who maybe from outward appearances look like they had some attributes that some might call developmental delay. Come into the museum, and one man I don't know how old he was, I won't even guess, was using a white cane to navigate the museum. And I thought, what a perfect time for me to go sit up in the gallery and to see how this person experienced the museum. And so I sat myself in the corner of the gallery where the piece that I chose was on exhibition. And I watched this person navigate the museum without interacting with one person, nor being able to interact with any of the pieces that were on display in the various galleries. Oftentimes, Tim, I think that the first step in this process for me is to decenter my own privilege and to really start thinking I can never be in Jen's shoes as a TSVI, nor a person who has an attribute of a vision impairment or low vision. I can never be in Taylor's shoes. I'm not a parent, and I'm certainly not a parent of a child who has, a visual impairment or blindness. But I'm thinking it is so important for us to, yes, inclusion is important, but I feel like we need to now move beyond just inclusion and just thinking, well, Miko has a right to walk in the doors of the museum. Clearly he does. But he also has a right to be there, to be present, and to belong in that space. Now, there are many adult-driven spaces where this is maybe not the space for any children at all. And I get that, I guess. I'm just somebody who's going to always push the boundary, who's always going to say, I wonder what if. And I think that's what drove me when I came off of being a consultant on the first project with the Clifford Steel Museum. And then that really got me thinking, well, what if? I wonder how a child with a visual impairment or blindness might experience this museum. And understand, that's just one attribute. And within that, in my conversations with Jen, I could never replicate the piece that I chose that would hit every avenue of what a child with a visual impairment or blindness is experiencing. Impossible to do that, but we have to start somewhere. And I think that the rightful presence, if you really dig into what that means, we want to remove economic barriers. We want to remove social barriers. We want to remove environmental barriers that keep young children, whatever attributes they bring to us, from experiencing something that is rightfully theirs to experience. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I am pretty passionate about asking why or why not, or having wonderings about how we might make something a space that is where children can be rightfully present.
Anyone else want to take that question?
I just want to say one thing, and I so appreciate Dr. Barla saying that, because he's so right. It isn't just about being like, oh, Miko, you're also like allowed to be in here. You know, like you, we built this stuff because you're allowed to be here. It really is about making people feel as like equal parts of the community, and that this stuff is accessible to them, and not as like an afterthought, but as an active member in society. This gives kids, my whole career has been around increasing representation. And I work mostly with Indigenous people, but in that you see that all of these spaces are built pretty strictly for able-bodied, you know, mostly white people. And so to give Miko this opportunity, to give other kids this opportunity, might go even further than just Miko being like, oh, I get to go to the museum and play. It might be like, oh, wow, I wonder if I could create art. And then he creates his own art and like, oh, wow, can I be an artist? And then he grows up to be an artist. Like, it opens a door for hobbies and jobs and, and active community members. And so the ripple effect of these things is not just Miko got to play in a museum. It could end up being that, you know, he builds these things for other kids, or he opens them. We just don't even know that the longevity of these experiences and what they offer children, how that representation is so vital in them seeing themselves in the future and the things that are accessible to them and the things that they're capable of doing.
Jen, did you want to add anything?
I was just going to say, you know, we always talk to our young adults and our teenagers when we're working with them, and even our parents, you know, we're working in a sighted world. Unfortunately, this world is built for sighted people. It's not built for our children. It's not even built for me. But how can we get through the day? You know, what are these things that have been so far proven to work for us and our kids and, you know, those that are around us? You know, if we include things in the beginning, if we accommodate and if we think about our children with visual impairments and our adults with other disabilities too, because it's not just, you know, sensory's for everybody. It's not just visual impairment. You know, this is for kids with other disabilities as well. If we put that at the forethought, the first thought, instead of coming back to later, it tends to bring more community awareness, more, you know, people get used to the idea of not just being for a sighted world or for a child that is typical, you know, because I mean, at the end of the day, they're all toddlers and they all kind of act the same. So we're thinking about children, you know, if we can just think about children first and then start going that way, you know, like what are things that children like, you know, and then up towards, you know, our adults with disabilities and things like that too. I think the biggest takeaway is if we just do this first, it would make, I think, things a lot more community involvement, a lot more acceptance in the world. But we don't, and that's okay. And that's why you work with your teachers for the visually impaired, or you work with your parents, because your parents have a lot of insight and information. We're not with these kids 24/7. You know, you work with their other providers, their, you know, family member, you know, you bring everybody together as much as you can. But again, I always go back to that, you know, bring in your teacher for the visually impaired, because we can offer a lot of insight to why you do feet first. Why are we offering a quiet environment? You know, there's reason. I always say there's method to the madness, you know.
I can appreciate that for sure. What is the status of the exhibit now, Michael? Is it still there for other people to experience, or are there plans to expand or do other pieces?
So no, the piece was never on display at the museum. That wasn't my choice. It is here at the Anchor Center.
Okay.
They have dedicated a space for it to be on permanent display here at the Anchor Center. And it's really important for me not just to hang that piece on the wall. So I have also included a photograph of the original piece and an explanation of what this thing is hanging on the wall and what was the process of how it came to be. And that's really important as well to me. So it is here at the Anchor Center for children and families and staff to experience and to enjoy. I do also want to bring up a couple of real quick points. Oftentimes in early learning, people think of art as arts and crafts. And you could certainly look at the piece that I built and someone might say, that's really cute. That's, oh, you know, it's artsy and craftsy. And, oh, you used a hot glue gun and you sewed stuff on and look at, you have jingle bells. And, you know, you could approach it from that perspective. That's not my preference, because I think that approaching it from that perspective really delegitimizes the work that we do in early learning and care. That from my perspective, art is a process, and there's much to be learned from how that piece came to be, how Miko interacted with that piece, and relative to the question you just asked, so now what? You know, we've had this one experience with this one piece that was translated. Where do we go from here? So that's important for me. Legitimizing of the work that we do in early learning and care is something I'm extremely passionate about. It's not just that we're taking care of children, it's that we are providing those early learning and prerequisite experiences that we want children to have in order for them to keep growing and keep learning. So that was an important piece for me to make sure that I conveyed when I was doing this work.
If there's anybody listening that would like to, you know, reach out, ask you additional questions, or maybe there's, you know, a museum administrator or even a school administrator that wants to contact you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, the best way to contact me, I would give my personal email, which is mbar1963@gmail.com. I did, Tim, have, when the poster was presented at the conference in May, I was not able to attend, but it was hung up for people to experience. I had a director of education for a museum in Tucson reach out to me and want to engage with me in some thought processes and thinking about how their museum can begin to think about young children. So this museum is a museum that is dedicated to miniature exhibits. And so all of those miniature exhibits are under glass or behind glass. And so, you know, I am going to go there at the end of August and begin to have some conversations with them about how they might think about the rightful presence of young children in a museum where we really want to touch things, but we're not allowed to touch those things. And it doesn't mean we have to touch everything that's in there, but let's start to think about how we might present something like a miniature exhibit of whatever it is, and have that be an experience that young children can engage in.
Before we move into our final segment, let's take a moment to recap where we've been. We started today hearing the story behind Michael's fellowship with the Clifford Still Museum and how he partnered with Jen to imagine what it would mean to translate a painting for a young child who has a visual impairment. We learned how texture, sound, light, and sensory exploration became the language of that translation. And then we stepped into the gallery with Taylor and Miko, watching how a toddler maps his world through feet, hands, and curiosity, and what that reveals about belonging, accessibility, and co-creating environments with the communities they are meant for. Now, to wrap up our conversation, it's time for one of my and your favorite parts of the show, the mystery question. I won't give it away, but let's just say it's something we all probably have on our minds more often than we admit.
Amazing. Amazing. That's great news. Well, best of luck with that. Taylor, Jen, thank you. Really appreciate your time and sharing your experiences. So I like to end every interview that I do with a mystery question. It's just a fun way to wrap up our conversation. And I have a very short stack of cards here that I've pre-screened. I don't know what question I'll pick, but I'll pick the question and then we all answer it. Does that sound okay?
Definitely.
All right, let's do it. Okay, here we go. Our mystery question is, name something on your to-do list that never gets done. Name something on your to-do list that never gets done. And I'm thinking, I'm a very inconsistent maker of lists. I love lists, but I don't always make them. See, that's the problem. Interesting question. Does anyone have an answer?
I do.
Michael, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. As a child, I always wanted a banjo, and I never got a banjo. So recently I bought a banjo and I started to teach myself with some online lessons, but I have stopped. So it has been on my to-do list for decades. I need to make that happen. But you know, we all know life gets in the way sometimes. I'm glad you asked that question because maybe it'll drive me back to that and be.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I need to hear some banjo, you know, some banjo music from Michael. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Who else has one?
Bingo. So, you know, being a teacher, you never really have free time. So in my free time that I never have, I try to crochet. don't ask me how it's going.
That's fantastic.
You know, I got the yarn. It's there.
That's right. Well, there you go. Maybe this is the conversation you needed to get back on that crocheting, you know, rhythm. So, all right. Taylor, do you have one?
Yes. So I am not one of those people that does a really good job of moving into spaces. We've lived in our house for 3 years now. And I did hang up these two pictures because they're in the background of every meeting that I have. But in my room right now, I can see four different framed pieces of art that I have not hung up. And every day I look at them and I'm like, oh, I should definitely hang that up because all I do now is dust them on the floors. That is something that is on my to-do list, like literally every weekend of like, okay, I need to go through and like start hanging up all my stuff. But I just don't. I walk into my room and I'm like, no, gotta do something else instead. So.
Absolutely. Okay. Okay. So you're making me feel a lot better about my life right now. So the thing that's been on my to-do list for literally months is my bathroom. We have like, you know, my wife and I have separate sinks, right? So she has her own sink and like light switch, and I have my own sink and light switch. And my light switch has had a short in it for months. And so like every time I flip on my light, it's like a ghost, you know, like flickers. And I have to like go up and down on the switch to try to get it just right so the light will stay on. And every time, like literally, I mean, multiple times a day, I'm doing this. And I go, I just need to fix this. I just need to turn off the electricity, go in there, reattach some wires or get a new thing. I still haven't done it.
Oh, I just thought of something, actually. I do have a framed picture downstairs that's hung up, and it is a picture of Miko at the museum.
It is a picture there you go.
That the museum photographer took, and he is exploring the bench that's in the middle. And like the picture that Dr. Barla replicated is actually in the background of him. But he's like face down on this bench, and you can see his little toes feeling the bottom because it's metal. As soon as I got that printed, I hung it up immediately. So I think that's the,
yay.
The flow I need to get into is just once it's home, it gets hung immediately. But that's
right,
in our
right,
living
exactly.
Room.
He loved that bench. That was so it was very fascinating to watch that, Tim, because he had his shoes and socks off, and the bench sits on some metal pieces that are curved, so he could step on that. And it was cold, I think, and the same reason why he had the bells on his cheek and then he bit one off. So from that very traumatic experience for me, and it didn't affect Taylor one bit, I couldn't sleep that night or some nights to come. But it did make me think, and I went back and adjusted. Instead of, I had sewn the bells on top of the fabric and then I encased them in some felt so that they still made noise, but a child wouldn't be able to bite them off.
There you go.
That was a lesson well learned with a lot of anxiety.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much for sharing that little bit about your life. And I hope all of us take this as a, you know, we can get that item off of our to-do list. So Michael Barla, Jen Taylor, Taylor Kingsbury, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
Yep. Yes. Thank you so much.
That was Michael Barla, Jen Taylor, and Taylor Kingsbury. Here's what I'm taking with me. The idea that translation, not replication, is the key to creating meaningful experiences for children who have visual impairment. And that co-creating with families and community partners isn't just a nice thing to do. It's the only way to build spaces where kids can be rightfully present. So here's one practical step for educators. Start by including accessibility in the first draft of the design process, whether it's a lesson plan, a classroom environment, or a field trip. Ask, who won't be able to access this? And how can we change that before we begin? I think that mindset shift matters. Share this episode with a colleague who's building inclusive schools.
rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and follow Think Inclusive wherever you get your podcasts. Shout out to my colleagues here at MCIE. Thanks for a great 2025. I'm looking forward to what we have in store for 2026. If you have a shout out you'd like for me to share on a future episode, email me at tvagus@mcie.org. Okay, time for the credits. Think Inclusive is brought to you by me, Tim Viegas. I write, edit, mix, master. I basically wear all the podcast hats and baseball caps. This show is a proud production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, scheduling and extra production help from Jill Wagoner. Our original music is by Miles Kredich, with extra vibes from Melody. Big thanks to our sponsors, IXL and Adaptiverse. Fun fact, New Year's resolutions aren't some modern self-help trend. They're actually one of the oldest traditions humans have. The Babylonians were making resolutions 4,000 years ago, mostly about returning borrowed farming tools, which honestly feels like the original be a good neighbor policy. Then the Romans picked it up and tied it to Janus, the two-faced god who looks backward and forward. That's basically what we do on New Year's, reflect a little, hope a little. And here in the US, January 1st wasn't even a big celebration for most of our history. It was there to settle debts and reset. The whole midnight countdown thing really didn't take off until the 20th century. In its core, the tradition hasn't really changed much. It's still about imagining how we can show up a little better for ourselves and for each other in the year ahead. What New Year's resolutions have you made and or broken already for 2026? Head nod to NPR for the fun fact information. Email me at tvagus@mcie.org. If you've made it this far, you're officially part of the Think Inclusive Inclusion crew. Want to help us keep moving the needle for inclusion? Head to mcie.org and click the donate button. Give $5, $10, $20. It helps us keep partnering with schools and districts to move inclusive practices forward and support educators doing the work. Find us on the socials almost everywhere at Think Inclusive. Thanks for hanging out. And remember, inclusion always works. From MCIE.
Podcast roll. Welcome in.